Here it is!
From deep inside your radio. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm in Chicago today on this solemn occasion, and it is a solemn occasion, but we do want to welcome to our family on this day the wonderfully talented Miss Katie Couric.
Harry Shearer, I'm going to get you.
Now, Katie, you really should drop it. It's long ago and far away, but welcome aboard. And what a special day it is, ladies and gentlemen, when Paul Wolfowitz can be back on TV, and nobody laughs. See, it's a somber day. Meanwhile, maybe you didn't know this. Just following up on a little thing from 10 years ago, in the digital wonderland, many of the nation's biggest fire departments spooked by allegations that Motorola's digital radio failures contributed to the deaths of at least 5 firefighters, the disabling of a 6th, and scores of close calls, have limited use of these gadgets. This is according to McClatchy newspapers. The gadgets acquired in a post-9/11 emergency communications spending splurge. The headlong, federally backed push to buy tens of billions of dollars in digital equipment, including radios priced as high as $6,000 each for a radio. We're giving them away. Gained momentum despite the lack of any government standard ensuring that they would perform for firefighters. I was just thinking of strippers. Multiple investigations and tests have since found flaws in the equipment made by Motorola and its rivals. Fire departments in New York, Chicago, Los Angeles, Boston, Phoenix, and Boise, where I'll be tomorrow night, communities that have spent tens of millions of dollars on the new equipment are so leery of problems, they won't use digital radios at fire scenes. Boston firefighters are not to use digital radios, says the radio supervisor for Boston's fire department. They don't have them because I said no, he says. Analog technology is stable and proven to be reliable for firefighters, he says. While computerized digital radios are great for building inspectors whose lives don't depend on their radios. Motorola, ladies and gentlemen, in the digital, leading us into the digital wonderland, just teaching us what we've learned, really, since 9/11. And speaking of which, the great wise man of American broadcasting has dropped by via a link to share with us an observation on this day. Tom, what can you share with us? What does the day mean to you?
Harry, you know, there's meaning to be gotten from this day. It illuminates what we've learned since 9/11. Two words sum it up.
Really?
Yeah. And they are living legacy.
Sorry?
Living legacy.
All right. We will think about that, Tom. Thank you so much. And, ladies and gentlemen, a personal recollection. 10 years ago, I was in Melbourne, Australia. Some of you may recall the broadcast I did from there. And I was there to do a television show. I was a guest about once a year for a couple weeks at a time, which was a sort of a cool idea. A bunch of witty people gathered together in prime time on live television, on network television in Australia, at 9:30 every Wednesday night, and kind of just riffed about what had been going on TV or in the news. And so Wednesday morning of that week, we gathered for a production meeting at 10 o'clock to discuss, would we do a show that night? And what kind of show would we do if we did? And around the table were all the members of the cast, and I was allowed to sit in on that because I was in the cast that week. The show was ad lib, and they never even wanted to know what you were going to talk about. No, save it for air. So this was sort of an oddly long, detailed production meeting. And we all just discussed, well, what are the other networks going to be doing? What would people expect? Are we going to try to do a funny show? Would we do it with an audience, or would we do it in an empty studio? What? So people literally exchanging views, you know, changing their minds depending on what somebody else said. An actual conversation, that is to say. And at the end of about an hour and a half, it was decided that really all things, all opinions considered, we would decide not to do the show. And we didn't. But before, and at the side of the table, taking notes during all this, was one of the show's producers. And just before the meeting broke up, I turned to my fellow cast members and I said, just for perspective, if we were in America, this conversation would have been held by all the producers sitting around the table, and the talent would be sitting at the corner of the table taking notes. Hello, welcome to the show.
Everybody get on your feet. You make me nervous when you're in your seat. Take off your shoes and pat your feet. We're doing a dance that can't be beat. We barefootin'. We barefootin'. We barefootin'. We barefootin'. Went to a party the other night. Long tall Sally was out of sight. Threw away a wig and her high sneakers too. She was doing a dance without any shoes. She was barefootin'. She was barefootin'. She was barefootin'. She was barefootin'. Hey, little girl with your red dress on, I bet you can barefoot all night long. Take off your shoes and throw them away. Come back and get them another day. We barefootin'. We barefootin'. We barefootin'. We barefootin'. Everybody get barefooted. Take off your shoes. Henry, he said to Sue, if I barefoot, would you barefoot too? Sue told John, I stole your stew. I was barefooting ever since I was two. It was barefooting. It was barefooting. It was barefooting. We barefooting. We barefooting.
From the Windy City, where Motorola is just moving some of its research facilities downtown, I'm informed. I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this edition of the show. And now, ladies and gentlemen, news from outside the bubble. And on the subject of what we've learned, McClatchy Newspapers also reports this. Just 2 weeks before the 9/11 hijackers did their act, members of a Saudi family abruptly vacated their luxury home near Sarasota, Florida, leaving a brand new car in the driveway, a refrigerator full of food, fruit on the counter, and an open safe in a master bedroom. In the weeks to follow, law enforcement agents not only discovered the home was visited by vehicles used by the 9/11 hijackers, but also phone calls were linked between the home and those who carried out the flights, including Mohammed Atta, in discoveries never before revealed to the public. New information now emerges that shows the FBI found troubling ties between the hijackers and residents in Sarasota, but the investigation was reported neither to Congress nor mentioned in the 9/11 Commission report. Former U.S. Senator Bob Graham, the former Florida Democrat who co-chaired the 9/11 Congressional Joint Inquiry, said he should have been told about the findings, saying, quote, "It opens the door to a new chapter of investigation as to the depth of the Saudi role in 9/11. No information relative to the named people in Sarasota was disclosed," unquote. The Justice Department, the lead agency that investigated the attacks, refused to comment, saying it will discuss only information already released. The Saudi residents then living at the home could not be reached, nor could the then owner of the house, the father of one of the residents. The home was sold in 2003. Hey, timing. Top of the market. Top of the market to you. For Graham, the connections between the hijackers and residents raise questions about whether other Saudi nationals in Florida knew of the impending attacks. Just, you know, in case the TV hadn't mentioned that. On other subjects outside the bubble, an innocent Iraqi civilian died in British Army custody after suffering, quote, an appalling episode of serious gratuitous violence, according to a public inquiry this week. The sustained abuse meted out to father of two, Baha Musa, 26, represented, quote, a very serious breach of discipline by members of the 1st Battalion of the Queen's Lancashire Regiment, the inquiry found. Inquiry Chairman Sir William Gage said a number of British soldiers, including the commanding officer, Colonel Jorge Mendonca, bore a, quote, heavy responsibility for the tragedy. Such an incident, he says, should not have happened and should never happen again. The inquiry condemned the corporate failure by the British Ministry of Defense that led to interrogation techniques banned by the British government in 1972, including hooding and making prisoners stand in painful stress positions. Now, where did they hear about those? Who else, what other army used those? Huh. It's bad apples, ladies and gentlemen. It's just bad apples. Just a lot of bad apples. Musa sustained 93 separate injuries, including fractured ribs and a broken nose, while in British custody over 36 hours. The inquiry condemned the, quote, lack of moral courage to report abuse, unquote, within the battalion. It said, quote, a large number, unquote, of soldiers assaulted Musa and nine Iraqis detained with him, and noted that many others, including several officers, must have known what was happening. The report also said the violence could not be described as a one-off because there was evidence that troops from that regiment abused and mistreated Iraqi civilians on other locations and other occasions. So, habitually bad apples, you see. Not spontaneously bad apples. The inquiry concluded Musa's death was caused by a combination of his weakened physical state, no food, no water, no sleep, no nothing, and a final struggle with his guards. It found that one soldier, Corporal, and not making this up, Corporal Donald Payne, violently assaulted Musa in the minutes before he died, punching and possibly kicking him and using a dangerous restraint method. Stay away from those apples. And any serious oil spill in the ice of the Arctic, the new frontier of oil exploration, is likely to be an uncontrollable environmental disaster, spoiling vast areas of the world's most untouched ecosystem, one of the world's leading polar scientists has told the British newspaper The Independent. Oil from an undersea leak will not only be very hard to deal with in Arctic conditions, it will interact with the surface sea ice and become absorbed in it, and therefore be transported by the ice for as much as 1,000 miles across the ocean. According to Peter Wadhams, professor of ocean physics, what does he know, at the University of Cambridge. The interaction means the Arctic oil rush, given the boost last week with a $3.2 billion investment from ExxonMobil, we know what we're doing, trust us, is likely to be the riskiest form of oil exploration ever undertaken. The riskiest! See, we are number one. News from outside the bubble, ladies and gentlemen. Copyrighted feature of this broadcast. The new F-bomb, foreclosure, rears its ugly head on today's broadcast. Counties across the United States are discovering that illegal or questionable mortgage paperwork, you've heard about that, going back to our interview with Eve Smith. Well, it seems as though it's, you see, it's far more widespread than originally thought, you see, tainting the deeds of tens of thousands of homes dating to the late 1990s. The suspicious documents could create legal trouble for homeowners for years. I just realized what Tom said. Living legacy. I wish he was still on the line.
You mean on the line?
Yeah. Mortgage papers are being invalidated by courts. Insurers are hesitant to write policies, and judges are blocking banks from foreclosing on homes. The findings by various county registers of deeds have hindered a settlement between the 50 state attorneys general and the big banks. The problem of shoddy mortgage paperwork, this is according to an AP report, comprises several shortcuts known collectively as robo-signing, At that time, it was thought to be, at the time last fall when it was first discovered, it was thought to be constrained to the affidavits that banks filed when mortgages are issued and somebody buys a house. But now, as county officials review years' worth of mortgage paperwork, in some cases combing through one page at a time, best way to do it, babe, they're finding suspicious signatures either signed with the same name by dozens of different people, improperly notarized, or signed without a review of the facts in the paperwork on all sorts of mortgage documents dating as far back as 1998. So it's a tradition. It's nothing wrong. It's a tradition. It's hallowed. It's the way we do things. It's, why shouldn't we do things that way? Because, no, it's a good, it's a thing. It's a, you know, it's part of our culture, put it that way. And while that shows how far back in the past all this goes, now it reaches into the future, or at least the present. Some of the largest mortgage servicers are still fabricating documents that should have been signed years ago and submitting them as evidence to foreclose on homeowners. This according to the American Banker, the magazine. The practice continues nearly a year after the companies were caught cutting corners in the robo-signing scandal. Several dozen documents reviewed by American Banker show as recently as August. Why, that's just last month. Some of the largest U.S. banks, including Bank of America, goodbye now, Wells Fargo, Ally Financial. Ally? What could be wrong with your Ally? And OneWest Financial were essentially backdating paperwork necessary to support their right to foreclose, even though the agreements under which these mortgages were securitized specifically states deadline dates by which that paperwork has to be certified. So you can't backdate it because it's against the thing of the thing. Some of the documents reviewed by American Banker included signatures by current bank employees claiming to represent lenders that no longer exist. But we miss them, and we'd like them back. Many banks are missing the original papers from when they securitized the mortgages, in some cases as long ago as 2005 and 6. They and some industry members, plaintiff's lawyers and some industry members say the related mortgage assignments showing transfers from one lender to another should have been completed and filed with document custodians at the time of transfer. It's one thing to not have the documents you're supposed to have, even though you told investors and the Securities and Exchange Commission you had them, said one lawyer, but they're making up new documents. Banks argued that creating such documents is a routine business practice. See what I mean? It's a tradition that simply memorializes actions that should have occurred years before. I should have paid that mortgage. I'm memorializing it now. Don't foreclose on me. Some courts have endorsed that view, but others, such as the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court, have found that this amounts to lack of sufficient evidence and renders foreclosures invalid. It's the way we've always done business. Why are you noticing now? What's wrong with you? The new F-bomb, ladies and gentlemen, foreclosure. But as if to say that's not enough from American Banker, now, I'm going to read the trades for you. From American Banker. Banks took $6 billion in kickbacks, investigators say. I will read it for you. And then there'll be another one, too. It's not about banks, so stick around. Don't cock around. Stick around. Many of the country's largest banks received $6 billion in kickbacks from mortgage insurers over the course of a decade, according to a previously undisclosed investigation by the Inspector General of the Department of Housing and Urban Development. The allegations referred to the Department of Justice for prosecution stem from lenders' demand that insurers cut them in on the lucrative business of insuring the mortgages they produced. They didn't make enough money selling the mortgages and wanted some of the money from insuring them. In exchange for their business, companies such as Citigroup, Wells Fargo, and Countrywide, part of Bank of America, so long now, allegedly required reinsurance partnerships on generous terms that violated at least one law that prohibited abusive home sales practices. Back in 2009, in a two-day presentation, HUD's team presented Justice Department attorneys with a thick binder of evidence that the major banks had engineered a decade-long kickback scheme. The Inspector General's staff concluded that banks and insurance companies had created elaborate financial structures that gave the appearance of reinsurance, but failed to transfer significant risk to the banks. Some of the deals were designed to return a 400% profit on a bank's investment and remain profitable even in the event of a real estate collapse. Can we please give some more money to the banks? I think they need it. Making matters worse, banks allegedly forced unknowing consumers to buy more insurance than they needed and failed to properly disclose the reinsurance agreements, another violation of the law. HUD's acting Inspector General Michael Stevens acknowledged the investigation's existence and expressed frustration that the case had not yet produced either a settlement or prosecution. This thing, he says, has been going on for too damn long. This is the trade magazine of the banking industry, ladies and gentlemen. American Banker. Banks threatened or punished companies that resisted in providing them these lucrative reinsurance deals. Prosecutors agreed the case was well worth taking when it was first referred to them. I'm bewildered by why this wasn't pursued on an aggressive basis, says a former HUD official. The aggressive forced revenue sharing with banks was ruining insurers' profitability and emboldening lenders to demand even more outlandish deals in a cycle that GE Capital Insurance called, quote, feeding the beast. At least some of the deals were so generous that banks would still turn a profit even in the event of catastrophic claims. Major banks deny their reinsurance agreements were illegal, but they have not been eager to defend them in court. In July, Bank of America, so long, spent $34 million to settle a class action suit accusing Countrywide of taking those kickbacks. More than a year and a half after the Department of Justice took over the case, no settlement has been reached, and there is serious doubt as to whether the case even remains active. People familiar with the case think it may have stagnated because demonstrating the captive reinsurance amounted to kickbacks would require accounting expertise the Department of Justice doesn't possess. I know a few accountants. You can hire them by the hour. Can we please help the banks? And from TVtechnology.com, as software creators and the ad industry continue to meld traditional and non-traditional advertising in the digital era, a handful of Fox and CBS affiliates in more than a dozen cities are now tapping into a fledgling system to locate pre-identified product placement availabilities within syndicated shows. It's in New York, Chicago, Phoenix, Philadelphia, San Francisco, and Cleveland. This patented technology is designed to seamlessly integrate product placements into existing program content, i.e. background wall posters, kitchen table items such as juice, beer, or food products, and even entire vehicles and street scenes. Consequently, a TV character in an old sitcom might drive off at the end of a scene in a brand new Honda Accord. The same scene aired in another city, she could be speeding off in a late model Ford Explorer. Seam BI's system strives to create a mostly automated online process for salespeople to choose product placements from existing available shows. What we're doing that's different, says the co-founder, is creating a new type of inventory called in-show ad units. The official says local salespeople are not required to go back to content owners for further approval. For example, a content owner may not want fast food services to be advertised within his or her show. That restriction remains. But once an order has been received, it's already been approved by the advertiser. The rendering farm is rendering the video, and then it sends a customized version of the episode at the relevant time directly to the station. Almost everything is automatic, he says. Except for the watching. And I'm suggesting that. Set your machine to watch it. You do something else. Maybe you were even having your machine record me while I read the trades for you. Copyrighted feature of this broadcast. And now,
clean, safe, too cheap to meet. Safe, cheap, too cheap to meet. Cheap, safe, too safe to meet. Safe, safe, too safe to meet.
News is our friend the Atom. Addy, you have any words on this special day?
Yeah, lessons learned.
All right, good. At least Addy doesn't have a speech impediment. Ladies and gentlemen, you know, he's got enough problems. Florida Power and Light's nuclear reactors received attention from regulators last week after a nuclear employee tested positive for alcohol.
Good reactor.
And two of the reactors made a list of 27 that may need upgrades to withstand earthquakes. The employee, a supervisor, tested positive for alcohol during a random screening. Federal regulators have downgraded the flood-idled nuclear power plant 20 miles north of Omaha, ranking it as one of the two poorest-performing reactors in the United States. Well, somebody has to be at the bottom of the list. That doesn't prove anything. U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission faulted Fort Calhoun Nuclear Station for the performance of its safety systems. Well, that's all. The power is good. Those needed to prevent potential problems from becoming potentially catastrophic. Fort Calhoun is now in a category with one other plant Pennsylvania Susquehanna nuclear power plant faces tougher scrutiny. But wait, there's more. From our friends in Japan, Japan's new trade minister apologized on Friday. This should be in the apologies of the week, but because it's nuclear-related, for calling the now-desolate area around the tsunami-hit nuclear power plant a town of death. A remark seen as insensitive to residents who had to evacuate because of radiation leak. Yoshio Hachira took office just a week ago as a new government replaced leaders, seen as unable to move Japan past the triple disaster. His comment came as he described his visit a day earlier to inspect damage and cheer workers at the Fuke plant. Sorry to say there was not a single soul in areas around the plant, he told reporters. Literally, it was like a town of death. I sincerely regret the remark that was misleading, said Hachiro. I take it back and deeply apologize. I only wanted to show my commitment to decontaminate the area. He said he did not mean death specifically, but was trying to describe the emptiness of the town. Opposition leaders quickly jumped on his remark. I believe he's resigned since then. A series of investigations at the James Fitzpatrick nuclear power plant near Syracuse has resulted in 4 workers being fired and 34 being disciplined. Federal prosecutors announced one of the fired workers is pleading guilty to falsifying tests of safety equipment at the plant. But the power is, when you turn the light, the electricity is good. It's like solid. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission notified the owner of the plant, Entergy, that it could face civil actions in the wake of the investigations. In the guilty plea, the worker admitted he failed to adequately perform tests to make sure the workers' emergency respirators were properly fitted and sealed, and then falsely documented that they were. Well, if you don't do the test, you have to falsely document. It's the way the banks have done business for years. Why now pick on the federal regulators? Oh, no, we got that. All right. Here's one that we didn't have already. The total amount of radioactive substances released into the sea as a result of the Fuke crisis is believed to have been 3 times the initial estimate by the plant's operator. You mean we shouldn't trust the plant's but they, why would they, what motive would they possibly have this? A team led by senior researcher Takuya Kobayashi estimated the actual quantity at 15,000 terabecquerels. Terabecquerels, it's such a beautiful word to describe that, isn't it? Terabecquerels, including substances in polluted water and substances released into the air that eventually fell into the water, you see, because of that damn gravity. That's who I blame. If it weren't for the gravity, that stuff would have stayed in the air and the oceans would be good. Tera means 1 trillion, in case you're wondering. The figure is more than triple the estimate by Tokyo Electric Power. The new estimate does not include cesium-134, meaning the actual total could be even higher. What, cesium had a good lawyer? And maybe that's it. Addie, that's not bad.
Oh, see? Things are looking good. And the power is great.
It is. It really is. And what are those 2 words?
Lessons learned.
Our friend the Atom. Clean, cheap, safe, and can pronounce his L's. Ladies and gentlemen, the new genetically engineered grass. Did you know about this? There's a new because the grass is not good enough. Grass isn't green enough. Won't be subjected to federal regulation because it was modified with a gene gun rather than bacteria. Now, to me, the news here is gene gun. They got a gene gun? All right, then. So, now you know how to get better-looking kids. Forget about trying to date models. Just get you a gene gun. The new strain of Kentucky bluegrass will likely be growing on American lawns very soon, where it will withstand prodigious amounts of the herbicide Roundup. This decision has provoked concern about a new generation of suburban superweeds. Well, why should they be limited to the cities? You know, the weeds want to have a chance for their kids to go to good schools, don't they? Concerns of cross-contamination between genetically modified and non-genetically modified foods are no longer reserved for crop farmers. Canadian researchers have found that transgenic Atlantic salmon can pass their genes on to wild salmon if they escape into the wild. Just things to worry about, ladies and gentlemen. Just a few things. Just a few things to think about while I'm over here doing something else. All right, I guess we'll get to this because it's good, and it has been occupying my attention for much of the last couple weeks. While you probably have been paying attention to other stuff, thanks to the national media. But this News Corporation scandal. New developments. Some good stuff. First of all, Tony Blair. Remember him? Tony Blair is godfather to one of Rupert Murdoch's children. One of the new ones. One of the ones that isn't in for the big money yet. This came out in an interview with Mrs. Murdoch, Wendy. The former prime minister was reportedly present in March last year when Murdoch's two daughters by his third wife, that would make six daughters if you just did the math, were baptized on the banks of the Jordan River, ladies and gentlemen. The information was not made public, and its disclosure comes out in an interview with Mrs. Murdoch in Vogue, of all places. See? My wife is right. I do need to read Vogue more often. Blair's close ties to the Murdochs could explain his reluctance to condemn the News International phone hacking and police corrupting scandal. Really, you think? Blair's spokesperson has categorically denied the allegation that he asked former Prime Minister Gordon Brown to put pressure on the Labour member of Parliament who helped expose the scandal to drop his investigation. As I say, Blair's spokesperson has denied it. Also, godparents to Grace 9 and Chloe 8. Isn't that late to baptize kids? Wow. That's taking a chance. Were Nicole Kidman and Hugh Jackman. No mention was made of Blair's role as godfather to Grace, and he did not appear in pictures of the ceremony, which took place at the spot where it is said that Jesus was baptized. It gets better. So, did they Photoshop him out? Or was he just invisible for the day? Blair's spokesman refused to comment, but a News Corporation source confirmed that Blair was godfather to Grace, as was Lachlan Murdoch, Rupert Murdoch's eldest son. So his eldest son is a godfather to his half-sister. It sounds absolutely Appalachian, but there you go. The technology company used by News International, part of News Corp, to store archived emails said this week that News had asked it to delete messages on 11 occasions during a 19-month period. HCL Technologies wrote to the parliamentary committee investigating all this. It says that it earlier said only 7 times had been asked to delete emails. Now it's up to 11. Do I hear 21? Rebecca Brooks, former head of News International and former editor of the now-shuttered News of the World, in fact, did resign from News Corporation, although we had David K. Johnston on this show a few weeks ago talking about all the number of different entities that a corporation whose name you recognize actually has as it exists in multiple jurisdictions around the world. So Rebecca Brooks, in fact, did resign from many News Corporation boards, but she's got some to go. She has not yet resigned from NI Syndication Limited, Times Newspapers Limited, News International Distributor Limited, News International Newspapers Limited, News International Publishers Limited, News International Trading Limited, News Corp Investments, News International Trading Ireland Limited, Ireland, News International Group Limited, News International Associated Services Limited, News Group Newspapers Limited, and News 2026 Limited, News Printers Assets Limited, News Printers Broxburn Limited, News Printers Group Limited, News Printers Knowlesley Limited, and News Printers Euro Central Limited. In addition to News International Advertisements Limited, Times Literary Supplement Limited, Times Newspapers Holdings Limited, and a few others. So she's got some resigning to do still. Executive at Murdoch's News International concerned, according to Reuters, that emails discussing questionable payments made to police by the now-shuttered tabloid News of the World may prove more problematic than those that discuss phone hacking. There are growing concerns inside the company that evidence of questionable payments to police or other British public officials could fuel investigations by U.S. authorities. The chief operating officer of News Corp, Chase Carey, reacting to the scandal over phone hacking, is holding discussions with some large investors over governance of the corporation and other concerns. The California State Teachers Retirement System, which holds 3.86 million shares of News Corp, plans to meet with top officials, sending letters, holding conference calls and meetings with News Corporation management. Because this is delicate, said a spokesman, we cannot say anything further about our efforts. Teachers. Retirement system. Isn't Fox News against teachers? I'm confused. The California Public Employees Retirement System won't be participating, even though they own 5 million non-voting shares. Well, why should they vote? They're public employees. I think they're running it right. And, ladies and gentlemen, the best is yet to come, at least for some of us, because the British newspaper The Telegraph, not a fan, not owned by Rupert Murdoch, reports that Rupert Murdoch and his son James, you remember they had that joint appearance before Parliament in July, you may recall seeing some of it, well, they're going to be questioned again, this time under oath in high court, which to me sounds like a high court. David Cameron, the Prime Minister of Britain, and other senior political figures are also likely to be questioned. The proceedings will be held in the same court as the official inquiry into the death of Diana, Princess Diana. So it's going to be in the Royal Courts of Justice, and they will be under oath. And presumably their MO will be quite similar to what we saw in July.
We're going to the High Court. We'll be under oath. They think they'll find some secrets, dig up the undergrowth. But we've got a strategy. It's more bat than crush.
I'll just talk too little. On the contrary, I'll talk to way too much.
We've sacked some loyal employees, dumped some lifelong friends. Our enemies are pretty sure they know how this tale ends. They'll dig up contradictions, try to trap us in our hutch.
I'm just going to talk too little. Well, and on the other hand, by comparison, I'm going to talk way too much.
I'm no stranger to the courts of law. After all, it's where I got unhitched from your ma.
Aw.
I'd be frightened of the court's caprice if we hadn't spent years paying off police.
My son has been my partner.
My dad has been my guide. Through thick and thin, we'd veer and spin with most pugnacious pride. Though they'll try to divide us, blood's thicker, fire than spittle.
So, here's my plan. I mean, it's very simple. I've laid it all out. I'm going to talk too much. Way too much. You see?
And I'll talk way too little.
Baby. Lord have mercy. And I'm going back for number two. Cause I just killed my baby. And I feel so darn great. Just can't wait. Just kiss my baby.
This is LeShow from Chicago, and now, the apologies of the week, won't you?
We're so sorry.
Well, that industry minister in Japan, Yoshiro Hachira, stepped down after he apologized for correcting another remark. According to Japanese newspaper reports, Hachiro, who was wearing protective clothing visiting Fukushima, moved as to wipe his sleeve against a reporter and jokingly said, "Look out, radiation!" He apologized, and he's gone. But it's cute. It was cute. CBSNews.com has severed its relationship with the host of a web show who sent out an erroneous tweet saying that Apple co-founder Steve Jobs had died. The offending tweet was sent from the Twitter account of What's Trending. CBSNews.com had been hosting the web series since May, but the show had no news-gathering partnership with CBS News, the show What's Trending. The owner of the thing, Shira Lazar, issued a somewhat flippant apology. Apologies, reports of Steve Jobs' death completely unconfirmed, live on. Later, she issued another apology from her own Twitter account. On behalf of all of us, we sincerely apologize for the inaccuracy of what was tweeted earlier today. Her original tweet was quickly deleted, but it spread instantly through the blogosphere.
Sorry.
And the damage had been done. CBS has apologized.
Hear us.
A Kansas high school teacher has apologized for stepping on an American flag while discussing free speech rights in her class. Officials at Circle High School in Towanda, Kansas, say Jennifer McKenzie, a government and history teacher, stepped on the flag while discussing controversial behaviors that are protected by the First Amendment. A parent, Cherie Davis, complained. Gonna say her name again, Cherie Davis. Principal Todd Dreifert said McKenzie has apologized. She's used the lesson in the past. Dreifert says it will no longer be allowed because we have First Amendment rights in this country, you see. It illustrates that, doesn't it? Deadline Vancouver, Alexandra Morton, a high-profile researcher and opponent of fish farms, has apologized to a Canadian commission for a scathing blog posting she made after she was sworn in as a witness. She was posting comments while under oath. Wonder if Rupert will tweet while he's under oath. One can only hope. A rapper upset the entire country with his tweet this week. F the FBI and the army troops fighting for what? Be your own man, says the rapper, actually in a newly released video. The lyrics released around the time of You Know What are causing quite a controversy. The rapper is in the process of taking the music offline. He's apologized and now repeatedly promised free concerts for the troops and an in-person apology. According to TMZ, soldiers are trying to get him banned from their bases through an online petition. And since I'm in Chicago, I haven't told you the name of that rapper until now. Soulja Boy. And now you know. Fox Sports is apologizing for an inappropriate video filmed at the USC campus in Los Angeles that critics say mocks Asian students, most of whom appear to know little about college football, by singling them out and prompting them to welcome Colorado and Utah to the Pac-12. The video has since been removed from Fox Sports' website, but an ethnic studies professor at the University of Colorado said he finds it troubling. Something troubling at Fox? CBS wasn't the only network attacked by Twitter hackers this week. A Twitter account belonging to NBC News was hacked by an entity that claimed falsely that an airplane had crashed at Ground Zero. The account was swiftly taken offline. The news division apologized. The incident was deemed serious enough that the news anchor Brian Williams read the apology out loud on NBC Nightly News. What did he do, Tom?
Read it out loud.
That's right. And Ryan Osborne, the director of social media for NBC News, yeah, they got one of those, said he saw the hacker's Twitter message appear online. He was already logged into the account and quickly realized his password had been changed. We're taking this breach very seriously. He added, in the quote of the week, quote, for anyone who works in journalism, it is terrifying to see people not respect facts. It is scary, unquote. The head of social media at NBC News. Where they're going to do the story about the pumps in New Orleans, I think tomorrow? Was it Tuesday, Tom? Tom's offline. Dateline Kabul, NATO apologized this week that an American soldier killed an Afghan journalist working for the BBC after mistaking him for a suicide bomber during an attack in southern Afghanistan in July. The acknowledgement came weeks after family members of the reporter had raised questions about his death and after an independent investigation had found strong clues suggesting the reporter was not killed by insurgents, as initially believed. NATO officials apologized to the family on Thursday and issued a two-page summary of the incident. And that apology and 25 cents will get you on the bus in Afghanistan. University of Miami quarterback Jack Jacory? Harris? Do you know?
No.
No, you don't know. You're going to the Bears game, though, right? Met the media this week after being named the new starter. But before he talked about football, he was contrite about his part in accepting impermissible benefits from former Miami booster Nevin Shapiro and apologized for having done so. So he's starting. He wins. Detroit Tigers TV analyst Rod Allen has apologized for saying this. The atmosphere of the ballpark was second to none. They had people at the concession stands that were dancing on top of the dugouts. They had some midgets around. They had some giants around. A half inning later, Allen took a moment to apologize for calling little people midgets. I want to get back to something I said last half inning. I used an incorrect term when I was referring to some of the little people who were part of the production in Buffalo. I used an incorrect term, and I apologize if I offended anyone out there for using that term that I used. And Brent Ratner, director of an upcoming film, has apologized for a joke about epilepsy that was included in the trailer for his upcoming action comedy, which stars blah, blah, blah. The apology comes after another actor whose 15-year-old son Jake has epilepsy called for a boycott. The joke involves calling a child Little Seizure Boy. Isn't that the song they play at Christmas time? I don't know. Do you? The apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen, it is a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. finally outside the bubble, just some things we've learned since 9/11. A Libyan Islamist has told how he and his family were rendered in an operation that the British intelligence service hatched in cooperation with Muammar Gaddafi's intelligence services. The rendition occurred shortly before Tony Blair paid his first visit to Gaddafi. The Islamist and his family were taken straight to prison. He was interrogated under torture while his family was in a nearby cell. And Tony Blair has denied knowing whether British security services cooperated in the rendition of Libyan dissidents to their homeland. Deniability. It's always good. Ladies and gentlemen, that's going to conclude this week's edition of the show. The program returns next week at the same time over the same stations over NPR worldwide throughout Europe on the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network up and down the east coast of North America by the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet. 7.415 megahertz shortwave on the mighty 104 in Berlin. Around the world via the internet at two different locations, live and archived whenever you want it. HarryShear.com and KCRW.com, available through your for your smartphone through Stitcher.com, available as a free podcast at KCRW.com. And it'll be just like doing what they said right after 9/11. Pay more attention to world affairs, if you'd agree to join with me then, would you? Alrighty, thank you very much. A tip of the show, chapeau to the San Diego, Pittsburgh, Hawaii, and Chicago desks.
Woo!
Thanks, as always, to Pam Halstead. Thanks to Liz Bustamante here at WBEZ Chicago for help with today's broadcast. This broadcast is on Twitter, at The Harry Shearer. And I'll be in Milwaukee tonight doing a Q&A for The Big Uneasy, and in Boise tomorrow night doing a Q&A for The Big Uneasy. The Big Uneasy is now on DVD and VOD. Details at TheBigUneasy.com.
We do not have time for this kind of silly.
You're right. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless. Thanks to Alex Rawls for help with the tribute to the late Wardell Kazare.